Mr. Mercer, re-1. Could you tell me, please, where you were born and when?
Yes, I was born on the 10th of August, 1929.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was originally in the Indian Army. He was commissioned into the Indian Army from Sandhurst in 1914. And served in France and then in Mesopotamia and then on the northwest country of India.
Did you go to school in London?
Yes, I did.
Whereabouts?
I can't remember the names of the schools that attended in London. I do remember that I attended a school in Bristol just before the war. I then went to Christ Hospital, the Blue Coat School, just outside Horsham, in 1939, just before the war broke out. And of course, I was there when the war started. At that time, we were living in North London. And we moved into a flat in Wexham. Between Wexford and Finchley during the war. Of course, we went through the Blitz there.
What do you remember personally about the Blitz?
I remember personally about the Blitz, apart from the searchlights and the anti-aircraft fire, I remember sometimes during the day when there would be large numbers of aircraft coming overhead, and of course, one didn't have to ask what nationality they were. Because obviously they were formations of German bombers.
This was in the Whetstone area?
Yes, this was in the Whetstone area, Finchley Whetstone. It was North London, in other words.
Do you remember any specific buildings or roads that were hit by bombs?
Yes, I remember one. Actually, I went round to sort of see it in the following morning, where part of the semi-detached house was demolished. I understood there had been casualties in there. But then again, in a sense, the war, I suppose somehow being, what was I then, 1942-43, so I was just about a teenager, and it seemed, I suppose, not so much an adventure, but perhaps not as real as it might have seemed to an older person.
Were there times when you were frightened?
No, I don't think there were. That I recall, no. No, I don't remember being frightened. I think I remember being curious, and more particularly, so I left Christ Hospital in early 1944 and started at Portsmouth Grammar School in autumn of that year. Portsmouth Grammar School at that time was evacuated to Southbourne near Bournemouth. But in the interim period, in the summer of 1944, as you recall, was the era of the flying bombs, the V1s. And of course, at that time, we were living in Orpington and right in flying bomb of Doodle Bag Alley. And I well remember the first flying bomb that I ever heard, which seemed to fly parallel with a road adjoining ours, and get to the top of that road, and then turn right-handed and fly along our road. Now, whether it hit a balloon cable or something in the process, possibly a barrage balloon cable, which diverted it. But there again, in the subsequent weeks during that summer, the flying bombs, I used to stand on the local railway bridge and watch the things going over. I don't remember any fear at all.
What exactly would you say?
I think excitement in a way and curiosity.
What would you see of the V1s?
Well, I would see the V1s actually coming over. Sometimes they used to go over, pass over and further on. Other times the engine would cut out and they'd glide overhead. Sometimes they'd simply dive into the ground with the engine still running. You know, and I'd just stand there and watch them.
What did they look like?
Well, just like a long black pencil with another little shorter pencil over the top, as it were, the stubby wings and the flame coming out of the back, of course. Yeah. Of course.
Do you remember any places that were hit in Orpington?
Yes, I do. So one particular occasion, a couple of Spitfires shot one down over a village just outside Orpington.
Called
Tonnington Lane. When I say the village, it was it was on the outskirts of Orpington, and it was a farm really. I suppose it was about a mile and a half from the centre of Orpington. And unfortunately, it fell on the farm and, of course, demolished everything and killed the occupants. But then again, I suppose the thought was that it was probably better that than that it should have been allowed to continue into, say, Dulwich, Fernhill, somewhere like that, and demolish a row of houses and kill perhaps 100 people.
Any others you remember?
One or two roundabout. Because, of course, they had a peculiar feature to it, and they had almost, I suppose, a graze field, you'd call it. So that as soon as they hit the ground or hit a building, they literally the blast simply went straight out sideways. So that the crater was very, very shallow, no more than perhaps a foot or a couple of feet deep at the most, just a hollow in the ground, and of course the damage was very widespread around.
Did you feel any sense of indignation that the area was being bombed?
Strange enough, no, I don't think I did. No.
Did you wonder why so many V1s were hitting your area?
I think we realised that obviously we were right in their flight path. They were obviously all being launched from more or less a particular point, and they were being aimed primarily at London, and of course some of them, well, a lot of them reached Croydon and beyond, but some of them of course fell short for various reasons, malfunction. They were a very, so I understand, very uncertain, or shall I say, had not been perfected. It was something that obviously Hitler wanted to push in quick to try and counteract our invasion of the Atlantic, the breaching of the Atlantic War. He obviously wanted to move these in quick, and they were very much not completely developed. And of course, malfunctions were quite common. And thus, as I say, some of them, you could never be certain how one was, if you could see one, you could never be certain that you were safe from it. It might go over and fall several miles further on. It might literally go into a dive and go screaming into the ground with the engine going full blast. Or it might cut out and glide. You could never, the only thing to do really, I suppose, was if you saw one, to take cover.
Did you ever see any of our fighters tip one over with their wing?
No, I didn't see that. That was an extremely extremely dangerous and hazardous practice. Now, I know it was, I understand it was done, but I understand also, and I found out not many years ago, that the Germans got wise to this and put explosive charges in the wings of the V1 so that a fighter nudging it would of course be blown up.
What about the V2s? Did you see any?
V2s, I was evacuated from there down to the south coast before they started. So I don't actually remember anything about the V2s. So really, by the time, although perhaps you're not going to get to the Korean War yet, but by the time the Korean War came along, I mean, I had already been under, if you like, under enemy fire. I already knew what bombs and things sounded like.
Let's go on to your joining the army now, and can you tell me how and when it happened?
Yes. At the end of the war, I was living with relatives in Cheltenham. My mother's sister and her husband, Brigadier and Mrs. Clark, both now deceased, of course. And they, their elder son, Dickie, Richard, was at that time still a prisoner of war with the Japanese. Their younger son was attending Chiltern College. He subsequently joined the Royal Marines. But at the end of the war, I was living with my aunt and uncle, and I suppose, well, if you look around, it's fair to say there's my father and his parents, his father and his mother, and various other members of the family, if you see the medals down there. My family goes back, I can trace it back to Waterloo, Mercer's Battery, Alexander Cavalry Mercer, who commanded Mercer's Battery or Mercer's troop at Waterloo, and I can trace the family all from there. In fact, well, that's the military part of it. And so I suppose it was natural that when I came of age, I would follow in the footsteps of my ancestors. My father wanted me to go into the Indian Army, but in 1947, the writing was clearly on the wall, and so obviously I joined the British Army. I went to the recruiting office, signed on the dotted line, 26th of March 1947, 5 years with the colours and 7 years with the reserve. And from there, I went to Northern Ireland to do my training in company with several other people. We did our training about 4.5 months in Northern Ireland. We left there in July 1947. We were burst, as it were. We were split up to our posted to our various regiments, because we were all badged to different regiments: Royal West Kents, Royal Ulster Rifles, Queens, Royal Fusiliers, Gloucesters, whatever it may be. And we were all posted to our various regiments. I was posted to Bulford Camp, which is sort of near Salisbury Plain, and I was at that time badged to the Gloucesters. I've never worn, apart from the General Service Corps cap badge with the crown and the cross swords, Dare's Hawk, apart from that, I've never worn any badges other than those of my regiment, the Gloucestershire Regiment. When I say badges, I mean, of course, you know, we wear two badges, one at the front and one at the back. So, from there, I was put on a draft, and yes, I was put on the draft for Fortunator to join the 2nd Battalion of my regiment. In those days, most regiments still had two regular battalions, although that was the period of the initial post-war army reorganisation, when a number of regiments were disbanded, other regiments were amalgamated. And regiments, of course, with two battalions, obviously the two battalions had to merge. And so I arrived in Jamaica on the 30th of November 1947, after a 15-day journey on a troop ship, whose main claim to fame was that it was, I think, a Q-ship in the First World War. The RMS Almanzora, 15,000 odd tons. And we were, in fact, its last passengers, if you like, because when it returned to the UK after this particular trip, it was going straight to the graveyard, straight to the graveyard. So we arrived in Jamaica on 30th of November 1947, and I was there in Jamaica for almost 2 years.
How did you go to Korea?
Well, Jamaica was definitely the peace, definitely the clean end of the stick, and Korea, if you like, was the dirty end of the stick. Now, we left Jamaica in September 1947, and I got home in September, had a scout leave. The battalion came home from Jamaica in November, December of that year, and the whole battalion was to be stationed at Colchester in Roman Way Camp. Which is just on the outskirts of the town. Colchester, as you know, is a military garrison town, has been for many years. And we were stationed at Romanway Camp, as I say. It was there that Colonel Kahn took over as commanding officer, more or less took over as CO. And Anthony Farrar Hockley, General Tony, as he now is, captain as he was then, he became the adjutant. And we had with us the RSM, Regiment Sergeant Major Jack Hobbs. He sadly now has also passed away. But he was a prisoner of war captured in France in 1940. So he knew plenty about me being in the bag. But that is advancing, wouldn't it? We did, from the beginning of 1950 to, yes, I suppose the first 6 or 7 months of 1950, we did the normal run of guard duties, training, exercises, PT, route marches, and so forth. And a couple of spells on duty, one with the dock strike and one with the Smithfield meat strike, and then called in to assist.
In what way?
Well, to assist in loading and unloading. In fact, I became a tally clerk for a couple of hours on unloading the MV motor vessel Dominion Monarch. And of course, as you can guess, as you realise, rationing was still in force very much in those days. This is 1950. Rationing was very much in force. And one of the cases, they were unloading mainly frozen cargo, frozen meat carcasses, and cases of butter and stuff like that. And of course, you know, you practically give an arm and a leg to get hold of extra butter. And one of the cases of butter, cardboard things, slipped and fell overboard. It fell between the boat and the jetty. And I've never seen so many police and security men in all my life. They sort of practically formed a solid wall around it. So, I mean, there was no hope of any of us sort of fishing in and saying, oh, well, here's a nice case of butter. They just formed a solid wall around it, and of course we couldn't get near.
Which dock was this?
One of the London docks.
Doesn't matter if you go on.
I can only give a guess if it was Keithwell's fifth dock, but I can't be certain of that. It was in the days, obviously, when the London docks were extremely busy. Then the other one was the Smithfield meat strike when we were hunting frozen carcasses around, and in some cases delivering But apart from that, we did a normal round of duties with an infantry battalion dowsy in peacetime in the UK until in the summer, in the late summer of 1950, we were called together as a battalion in the gymnasium at Romanway Camp, and we were addressed by the commanding officer, and we were told that we had been earmarked for active service in the Far East. Quote, active service in the Far East, unquote, if you like. Now, we knew that, well, we obviously we read the papers, and we knew Korean, you know, that North Korea invaded South Korea and so forth, and the rest of it. In the early stages, we knew that. Now, the only other place it could have been was possibly Malaya, but we knew, really, that the CO would not call us together and tell us in rather somber tones that we had been selected for active service in the Far East if we were simply going out to relieve another battalion in Malaya. So obviously, there was, you know, rather more to it than that. And eventually, of course, we came to know that it was going to be Korea. And everything was very secret, you know, hush, hush, don't tell it, you know. But, and we had vehicles, all our vehicles had to be remarked, or repainted and marked with the member from the last war, when Allied vehicles had that white star painted on them, on the bonnet and on the sides. And that was how our vehicles were going to be done. And all this had to be very secretive. And yet, the vehicles were disappearing from our camp, fairly plain khaki. And they were coming back, perhaps the following day, to our camp, or later that same day, with all these white stars emblazoned on them. So obviously, the local population must have realised something was happening. And when they finally took us down to the station early one morning to get on the troop train to go to Southampton, instead of going straight down through the town, we did a massive detour around the outskirts, presumably so that the local population would not see us, or would not realise that we were on the move. But I'm pretty sure that most people in the town realised that we were where we were going, because we were not the only ones. There were the Ulster Rifles, the Northumberland Fusiliers, Headquarters 29 Brigade under Tom Brody. He's still alive, incidentally. Probably nearer 90 than 80, but he's still alive. So. And he, you know, as I say, we went down to Southampton, got on the Empire Windrush, troop ship, and 6 weeks later, landed at Busan.
Was the journey uneventful?
Yes. It was uneventful, apart from, well, the Empire Windrush was built in 1931 by Blom and Boss of Hamburg. Now, I know that because it said so on the metal plate on the ship, in case you're wondering that I've got. I'm not an expert on knowledgeable on ships. I'm just saying that was on the metal plate on the bulkhead. And it was built there in 1931, and it was apparently, before the war, it was what they call the Germans call a strength through joy boat. In other words, a floating brothel, I suppose, in a sense. That's what we were told. Anyhow, the Germans scuttled it during the war, at the end of the war, and it was taken together with other boats. It was raised and taken as reparations, part of the reparations. Fair enough. But, again, so the story goes, our Admiralty, I suppose it would be, the Board of Admiralty, would not do the job properly. Because, of course, remember, it had been scuttled, so, of course, the sea cots had been opened, and the seawater had gotten gushed in all over the engine and everything. So they kind of just dried it out and sort of titivated it and sort of said, oh, well, that'll be okay, fine. Instead of what they should have done would have been to completely re-engine it, done the thing completely, but they didn't. They just patched it up and said, oh, that'll be okay. And the Windrush, from then on until it finally caught fire and sank in lead in 54. It was renowned for breaking down and something going wrong at least once on every voyage. And our voyage was no exception. Apart from the fact of drifting in the Indian Ocean for an hour or two while they tried to patch up the engines, we almost ran aground at Port Said, and it was only full of stern both. And a churning up of tons and tons and tons of mud, muddy water that prevented us, I think, from going aground. I don't know what caused that. I suppose that's a navigation error, but perhaps there again, perhaps a steering went or something. But anyhow, it was an interesting ship, as well as Windrush, two funnels, 14,000 odd tons.
So you arrived at Busan, when was this?
Busan after a 6 week voyage. We left Southampton on about the 2nd of October 1950, and we arrived at Busan on Friday the 10th of November that same year. About a 6 week journey.
What did you personally feel about the war and the necessity for conducting it before you went?
I will answer that quite simply, I was a regular soldier. I had joined the army in 1947 for two reasons, apart from the family background. The two reasons were travel and adventure. And, obviously, I felt that here was going to be an opportunity when I could put my training into effect. I didn't, I certainly didn't look deeply at the political powers of Air Force, whether we should be there or we shouldn't be there. It was just, it was an opportunity to, it was a job to do, and we had to go and do it.
What were your first impressions at Pusan?
Yuck.
Why?
It smelled. I mean, I'm not going to, all right, if any Koreans ever listen to this tape, well, that's just unfortunate. I will have to put up with it. But I mean, you know, I don't mean any hurt against them at all, because we've got an extremely friendly relationship now with the Republic of Korea's games. You've probably heard of trade and so forth. But it smelt, mainly because of the primitive conditions which existed there anyway, plus the fact that Pusan was the last resting place, if you like, for a lot of refugees, apart from the vast amount of military equipment and personnel being poured into it during that time. Remember, this is November 1950, and the war, Korean War, has only been on for a matter of four and a half months. In that time, much has happened, including, as I say, the influx into that area, into the Pusan area, in that southeast corner of the Korean Peninsula. Thousands and thousands and thousands of refugees. And of course, you know, it was a question of sewerage, toilet facilities, excrement, call it what you do. And, you know, it was just the Americans did describe it in a particular manner, which I won't repeat here. But it really was pretty rotten. And as I said, we arrived there we entered the port in the morning of the 10th, on the Friday morning. We anchored, pulled up to the jetty. We were greeted by the inevitable American Negro band, Cimbilia Blues and all the other typical tunes, and also by a South Korean naval band, of which I took a took a photograph, and I shouldn't, because it had a big notice on the dockside, no pictures. Nonetheless, I did manage to take a photograph of them. But then we disembarked in the early hours of the following morning, marched round to the railway station, got on the train, and off we went northwards. When I say train, the only thing that was complete and proper about that train was that each carriage had the requisite number of wheels. Other than that, there were very few, if any, windows. The seats were wood. There was no heating, obviously. And it was pretty chilly in the winter of 50-51, winter of 1950-51, even for Korea, we were told,